Welcome to Mom in Mind. I'm perinatal psychologist and host Dr. Kat. There's more to the story than just postpartum depression, and this podcast aims to share it all, from personal stories and lived experience to experts who break down the ups and downs of life from getting pregnant, pregnancy, perinatal loss, and postpartum adjustment to parenthood. While this is not psychotherapy or medical advice, it is all of the stuff you ever wanted to know about mental health and new parenthood.
Welcome back to the Mom in Mind podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Kat. On this episode, I'm talking with Tiffany Engen, who is a full-time mom of two children and a survivor of multiple perinatal mood and anxiety disorders. She is a strong advocate for maternal mental health, a full-spectrum doula, birth photographer, perinatal educator, and also perinatal mental health certified. Tiffany volunteers as a support coordinator and peer mentor with PSI. There are many things in her story that I feel like are really important for people to be aware of. One is when there are diagnoses in childhood, whether they're diagnosed correctly or misdiagnosed, those types of things can be a risk factor for perinatal mental health issues later on in life. She also talks about having a loss of a parent during her first pregnancy and the incredible stress and impact that that had on her experience of pregnancy and postpartum. And in her second pregnancy, the development of very intense intrusive thoughts that were debilitating for her. And how she coped during a very, very intense period of time where she did not have the support system she needed, didn't have a full community. Although there were one or two people that were lifelines for her when somebody's going through something so intense and doesn't feel like they can talk about it, it is very important to have a support system in place and do as much preventative work ahead of time as possible when you know you have risk factors. A lot of times people don't know that they have risk factors. And Tiffany's experience is multifaceted. There are a lot of things at play for her that have contributed to how and why she felt the way that she felt. So I'm grateful for her coming on, and let's talk with Tiffany. Welcome, Tiffany. Thank you for being here.
Thank you for this opportunity.
Yeah, I'm really happy that you're going to share your story. And I know a little bit from what you told me before we started that some of your story has a backdrop that starts in childhood. So I'd love for you to start there and let us know about what happened for you.
Yeah, so my story is a bit multifaceted because I grew up in a world that is for neurotypical people, and I am neurodivergent. And so as a small child, I was given medications very early on to try and treat some of my neurodivergence. And it didn't go that well. I had a lot of side effects. I had a lot of adverse reactions and things like that. So my mother discontinued that medication. But about a couple years, I want to say maybe 2 years after discontinuing that medication, I developed panic attacks pretty severely at age 12. So I was medicated again. They didn't really, you know, I think back then in the 90s, there wasn't many solutions for children who were experiencing what I was experiencing. Mm-hmm. So I was put on Paxil, which is a pretty intense medication for a young child. And I stayed on that probably until I was 18. I had always really wanted to get off that medication because I had such intense withdrawal. Sometimes if I missed a dose, and it just was really kind of not very effective either. I still had pretty severe panic attacks, and they had given me, you know, additional medication that was like benzodiazepines to try and manage those acute panic attacks. Mm-hmm.
As needed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. They were like, you know, in the middle of a severe panic attack, take this Valium or this Ativan or whatever. I think around 18, because I had gotten married and I knew that there was a potential for me to conceive, I decided to get off that medication and was put on Effexor because they said at that point it was like the safer one if I were to conceive. So I was on Effexor for about 3 years, I think. And at that point, I really just wanted to be free from prescription medications. I wanted to, you know, just be in my body. So I had attempted to titrate off of meds. And this was, you know, during a divorce. I had recently been divorced and I was trying to get off medications also because I was concerned about being able to afford them and access them. Sure. So that was a huge concern as well. So I decided to titrate off of medications and I was pretty successful. I was just about on the lowest dose possible that I had ever been on in my entire life. But when I conceived my son, so I got off everything once I found out I was pregnant, and I had a few weeks in there that I was really trying to do my best to just kind of cope with the experience. And it was really, really hard. I had no skills at that point in my life to manage all the symptoms that I was enduring. So my care providers put me on Zoloft. That was the one that they deemed, you know, safe for pregnancy. And I remained on that medication, I think, until about 2.5 years postpartum, because I didn't want him to continue to breastfeed and receive that medication through me. I really wanted to get everything out of our systems. So I eventually fully liberated myself from that medication, like I said, about 2.5 years postpartum.
Can I ask if during the time you were taking it, were your symptoms like better managed, or like, did you feel okay?
I think it's a very complicated question because I had a lot of unacknowledged PTSD. So I think there was, you know, at that point, things that I was just trying to shut out and shut down and quiet without really realizing that that was behind a lot of my panic attacks and a lot of my anxiety. And so the medications just sort of muted, I think, things, but they didn't fully eliminate any of what was going on. I still had a lot of triggers. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah. I think it's a good point, or, you know, a good thing for people to hear too, that you're right. If there's still a lot of unhealed, unprocessed, especially with trauma, medication can help to a point. And then I think, as you were saying before, and I don't know about this time in your life, but when you first were starting with, you know, trying to get off medications, you didn't quite have the skill set or tools, or maybe, mm-hmm. I don't know, you know, sometimes people don't even have a grasp yet on what all is impacting them.
Yeah, I didn't have an awareness, an awareness of like what I was even really going and dealing with. I just, you know, I kind of grew up with this fundamental belief that I was broken, that like just something was wrong with me. It was really hard to grow up with that because, one, being, you know, the neurodivergent kid in a family, there was a lot of, you know, pointing the finger and like labeling me as difficult and bad and, you know, dramatic and all of those negative associations, right? But there was no understanding that I was just different and I needed a different environment. And so that's why there was so much complex PTSD. There was so much complex childhood trauma. It was so much built up in my nervous system, in my body, that I think, you know, maybe under different circumstances with different supports and stuff, I could have had that awareness sooner. And medications may have been more effective for me, but due to, you know, the certain ingredients in my soup, it just wasn't.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you for expanding on that. Okay. So you said 2.5 years postpartum?
Yeah. I breastfed my son for about 3.5 years. And so I really, at that point, was like, I don't want him getting this in my milk. I didn't realize at the time, too, that he was also neurodivergent. And so I thought maybe the medications were contributing to the things that, you know, his behaviors and the things that I was experiencing with him as a toddler. So I wanted to get that, you know, out of the equation, and also just finally, you know, not have to be sort of ball and chained by this prescription that I had to always have at all times. So yeah, I did wean myself off of that, and he did continue to breastfeed for about a year after, you know, eliminating that medication. And then I kind of was on my own journey to discovering his neurodivergence, and then therefore acknowledging and re-realizing my own, because I think for a long time I rejected it. I was like, there's nothing wrong with me, you know, this isn't true. So it took a really long time.
From childhood wasn't
true. Yeah, because it was just very painful, you know. It was very painful for me. It felt very stigmatizing, and so I rejected a lot of it and didn't realize at that time I don't know the word that I'm looking for, but basically the freedom that comes with like finally fully embracing who I am and my differences and acknowledging and loving them instead of, you know, trying to bury them away.
Right. That's powerful. It is. Because otherwise you're just fighting with yourself the whole time, and that sucks.
It's awful. And I think I've finally come to a place now in my mid-30s of just accepting that these are my differences and this is how, you know, like how I am. And there's nothing wrong with that. It's just a difference, you know?
Right. Right. For sure.
Yeah.
I think that's helpful. You know, a lot of people are in that struggle and, you know, more and more people that I'm talking to on the podcast as well are finding out about their neurodivergence after having kids or similar to you, like seeing something in their children and learning that they also are dealing with something or had been dealing with something.
The main thing with my son also was I had lost my father at 6 months postpartum. And so I was dealing with a lot of grief and loss there. Because a lot of my childhood trauma was related to being afraid of losing him. He was very sick from very early on in my life. When I was about 3 or 4, he almost died. And I carried that like traumatic fear of like, is he going to see me grow up? Is he going to be around? When is he going to die? And so for that to finally come to fruition at, you know, such a vulnerable time for me was really intense to, you know, change the whole entire family dynamic. He was no longer there. He was also the parent that I was most connected with in childhood versus my mother. There was a lot of mother wounding in my early years. And so it was hard to be a mom and not feel connected to my own mom and not have a parent to turn to for that guidance. But it facilitated a lot of healing in that relationship with my mother that needed to happen, which was really difficult and painful and messy.
For sure.
But it did initiate that process, you know, with him being gone.
So, right. I mean, grief complicates everything, especially when it's such a key person in your life. And I know for a lot of people, it's hard to differentiate and often not possible to differentiate like grief from depression or anxiety. It's just all one big pile.
It was one big mess.
Yeah. And the grief process in and of its own is all quite messy. That meaning, you know, feelings all the time, everywhere. You don't know when. You don't know how intense it will be. And
yeah, that's because I remember, you know, having that baby and like not wanting to feed myself, not wanting to get up and shower. Not wanting to, like, just wanting to cry all the time, but having to tend to my newborn because I was solo parenting at the time and I didn't have, you know, I didn't have any help. And there was like no one there to pick up when I couldn't fall apart completely.
Right.
So I think that is really important to discuss for a lot of people, especially for parents who are losing their parent and becoming a parent themselves.
Yeah.
You're not allotted the time to fully fall apart that you need in order to move forward. So I've had to bit by bit, piece by piece, process that grief over the last 12 years in chunks. You know what I mean? Like I've never been able to fully get through it, but it's been a journey of processing that loss.
This podcast is sponsored by Paired. One of the things I hear weekly is how clients feel distant or not as connected to their partners, and also how they'd like to feel heard and seen by their partners. So for all you partners out there, it might be time to try Paired. It's an app that helps couples connect in a meaningful way, especially for couples who either feel disconnected, don't have time to sit down together, or who are just wanting to keep the connection going. This app is great. My husband and I are on it, and one of the things I love are the games where I answer a set of fun or interesting questions, and then he does the same, and we see where our answers line up or are different. It's a really cool way of learning something new about him, even though we've been together over 20 years. And there are a bunch of other great questions geared towards connection and understanding and intimacy that, when you share your answers, can help you and your partner understand each other better. Share the love this Mother's Day by going to paired.com/mind to get a 7-day free trial and 25% off if you sign up for a subscription. That's paired.com/mind to sign up today. Let's give the gift of connection this Mother's Day. A happier relationship starts here.
This podcast is supported by Factor. If you want stress-free and ready-to-eat meals for you and your family, then Factor it is. These meals are fresh and crafted by chefs, and all of that means that in 2 minutes, you can be eating a quality meal that you can really taste because it's never been frozen. You just heat and serve. Yesterday for lunch, I had the honey mustard chicken with green beans and potatoes, and it was so full of flavor. And it was also just the right amount of food to keep me going for the day and feeling good with the amount of protein that I needed. And what's cool is I'm going out of town for a little bit, and it was really easy to put the delivery on pause and set it up for when I return. Head to factormeals.com/momandmind50 and use code momandmind50 to get 50% off your first box, plus 20% off your next box. That's code momandmind50 at factormeals.com/momandmind50 to get 50% off your first box, plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
There's so much happening already within yourself about your transition into being a parent. On its own is a lot to process and try and figure out. And then this added complexity of grief and figuring out things that, oh my gosh, it's an incredible amount of stress you had at that time.
Yeah, it was really hard to just have to, you know, feel so much pain while also trying to be present for this new life that I brought into the world and figure out who I am as a mom and what does that mean and look like and how do I do this thing? But also having kind of lost a little bit of my will to live, you know, because of losing my dad. And just that was my first probably true significant loss in life. I've had so many things happen since then. And, you know, I've had such an intricate dance with grief and impermanence after that loss. But that was such a catalyst of change for me.
Yeah, it's quite intense.
Yeah.
So after you coming off of the medications, how did you fare? What was that like for you?
You know, I had a lot of learning to do. I had a lot of, you know, because when you kind of grow up for so many years having that tiny bottle of Ativan or Valium in your purse, and you know that that's the first thing you reach for when you're having an acute panic attack, and you're no longer doing that, like now you have to redirect to other coping strategies and find like what else can help you in that moment and how to be with such intense feelings without trying to quiet them. So it was a huge adjustment period, and I had a lot going on. Like I said, you know, I was learning my son was neurodivergent, and he had lots of big feelings and lots of meltdowns and he was a very high needs child. So I was pouring so much into my son, and I was trying to navigate my relationship with his father at that point and trying to figure out how to, you know, bring us back together and bring peace. And so there was a lot of moving parts and a lot of very little support, very little guidance in there. But, you know, I think it was one of those things that was one day at a time, one minute at a time, you know, just very small chunks of trying to cope.
I mean, it sounds like that journey was you figuring it out without support means like no therapy, you know, family giving you tips or tricks or supportive ones anyways.
Yeah, I mean, I did have my brother. My brother was always my person that I would call, like, you know, in a crisis, panic attack or whatever, like, help me. So he was doing his best to try to, you know, guide me as much as he could with what he had at the time. But, you know, it did lead me to realize, like, I needed something more. I needed to find somebody just for me that had a little bit of a removed perspective instead of being so close in the family, right? So that was sort of like my first, I'm going to need to find something else. I'm going to need to find somebody. But it took me a long time to act on it because, you know, there is so much concern and stigma with like, how is someone going to interpret what I'm saying? Are they going to understand me? Are they going to take it the wrong way? Is it going to escalate into something that I don't want to deal with? Or is this going to actually be helpful? And I think that is probably the main concern for most people experiencing perinatal mental health issues is they're terrified to say the wrong thing to the wrong person. And then, you know, have things sort of snowball from there. But yeah, I want to lead us into why I came on today, because my experience with my son, while it was massive in its own right, I think due to the medications, it wasn't as traumatic for me as it was with my daughter. When I conceived my daughter a few years later, I had been completely opposed to, you know, any medications, and I had been off them for a couple of years. And so while I was, you know, well acquainted with my anxiety and depression at that point, and then finally coming into awareness about my complex childhood trauma, my nervous system just could not handle what was coming from that pregnancy. Like, whatever she brought in with her into my body was so shocking. And it was like a light switch. Like, it literally just happened. I can pinpoint where I was, the time of day. Oh. Like, it was like there was a before this and an after this.
Oh, gosh.
And it made no sense, you know? Like,
this is during pregnancy.
Yeah, during my second trimester of being pregnant with her.
Okay.
You know, I was just taking my son to the park. We were out, you know, trying to play at the park. And everything prior to that moment was normal, you know, like, I guess. But once something changed, I don't know what it was. It was like a light switch went off in my brain and I had my first very disturbing intrusive thought and it scared the shit out of me. Mm-hmm. And I like packed him up and ran out of that park and was like never going back. And I had no idea what happened and why. And I was like, what did I just see in my head? Like, that was so disturbing and scary. And I didn't, you know, I couldn't process it. So it became, you know, its own trauma in my body, right? Yes. Like, when you can't process something, you don't know what's happening. It just gets stuck.
Yeah.
And then it just became a pattern after that. And so my world got so much smaller during that pregnancy. Because I started to isolate. I didn't want to be in public spaces. I thought if I avoided this place or avoided that place, then I wouldn't trigger these things that I was seeing. And so I was really reduced to such a small space at that point.
Okay. So how, like, frequently were you experiencing this intensity? Was it like
daily?
Multiple times a day?
Yeah. It was daily, multiple times a day. It was constant, it felt like, you know. I couldn't really, there was no really escaping what was playing out in my mind. And I was so ashamed and so afraid to like relay what I was seeing to anybody that I think I only told one friend at the time what was happening. And she was so understanding and gentle with me and so loving. Like, she just, I love her so much. She's in Australia now, so I don't really get to see her or talk to her, but she was very supportive in that. You know, even she couldn't understand it. She couldn't label it. She couldn't tell me what was happening. But she was like, it's okay. You know, like, I'm here. Even though you're expressing, you know, these horrifying things to me, I still love you. And you're such a strong mom.
That's beautiful.
It was. It was
need. That's what
it was. It was so fantastic to have her, because I think I would have lost it completely if I didn't have that.
Right. Right. I mean, like you were saying, it's so isolating. It can be so scary. And so disorienting, like,
yeah,
the kind of what is happening, why is it happening,
can
get really deep and entrenched and start to make you feel terrible about yourself.
It did. I thought I was a monster. I was like, there's no other explanation for what I'm seeing. Is either I'm a horrible person or I'm, you know, being tormented by some demonic spirit or something. And like, my mind just was trying to make up any justification as to like what was happening. Mm-hmm. So I sought out, you know, a shaman. I sought out like someone who could do a clearing for me. I was buying crystals. I was trying to sage my home. I was like trying to find any answer to why something was just now affecting me for the first time in my life. And it didn't make sense.
So this was like in your internal experience was primarily the intrusive thoughts. And that was the scary part. And it almost, like you said, it felt like she brought something with her in a way, your daughter, in the pregnancy. So during that time, how were you coping with it? You know, I mean, I hear that like reaching out to the shaman and all of that stuff, which totally makes, you know, a lot of sense. You're trying to just relieve yourself in whatever way you can.
Yeah. Figure out how. I was grasping at straws.
Sure. Yeah, was happening like in the moment or directly after, or, you know, how were you coping with it?
Like I said, my world got really small. I wasn't socializing as much. I wasn't able to take my son on these play dates. I wasn't able to go to the park very often. I wasn't able to, you know, the grocery stores were really exasperating because I was having to use all of my strength to cope with the sensations that I was feeling in my body. The anxiety, the sort of trauma response that I would have to these intrusive thoughts. Mm-hmm. And I would rush back home and just try to like hide out in this space. And I cried a lot on the phone to my brother. I cried a lot on the phone to my best friend. I, you know, tried to escape with TV and just anything that people could cope with, right?
Sure.
At the time. Honestly, it's so much of a blur back then, I think, because of the way that my body responded to it. It protects me from a lot of like revisiting of that moment, because it was just so hard and so painful and so shockingly isolating that I can only access tidbits, you know, which is hard too. There's so much grief because I didn't get to really fully be present for my daughter's infancy. I missed a lot of my son's, you know, younger years because I was just trying to survive and I wasn't thriving. I wasn't able to do, you know, and be a happy mom and be present for them. It was like all a blur of just trying to breastfeed her, trying to survive that. You know, she had oral ties, and so breastfeeding her was really challenging in comparison to my son. I suffered a lot, and I had a lot of paranoia about her growth and her weight gain, and I couldn't see, you know, that she was doing well. Like in my head, it was like a body dysmorphia type experience. You know, I was so worried about her all the time, and I couldn't see that she was okay.
Like, did it?
It was. It was a lot of anxiety. It was a lot of that panic attack, heart racing, body tingling, you know, upset stomach. Like, I couldn't eat after I had her. I was so nauseous and I was so stressed out.
Okay.
From worry and from anxiety and from just my nervous system being so dysregulated that I struggled with eating. I lost so much weight so rapidly postpartum that I thought I was dying. I became so fixated on all of my symptoms that I was experiencing head to toe. So my OCD presented, you know how there's multiple categories, right? For intrusive thoughts.
Yeah.
And mine presented probably almost all of them. I had, you know, the health and contamination OCD. So I was very afraid to like bring my kids out to the park and socialize. I couldn't let anyone in because I was always worried that they were going to come in and get us sick and then I wouldn't be able to take care of anybody. I had harm OCD. So I was having intrusive thoughts about hurting my babies and my son. And I was trying to keep a distance to make sure that I wasn't going to do anything and not realize it. I think that was my main concern, was that I was afraid that I would do something and not know that I did it until afterwards. And then I would be, you know, devastated. So I was terrified to
just ask that. I think that's an important point about what it feels like. In your experience, was there ever a time where you weren't? How do I want to ask it? There's like a level of hypervigilance that comes with what you're describing. It's almost like you're paying attention to so much and so many details, and so part of the worry is that you will miss some of that. Like you won't see some of it, but also you're like paying attention more than you ever have about it. So the amount of attention you're actually paying to something versus the fear that you won't, it doesn't match up. But that's also part of this, the OCD feeling, is it? Mm-hmm. And it feels like you can never do it.
Yeah, it was utterly exhausting and I couldn't sleep. So I was terrified to, my body couldn't settle. I couldn't relax. It was just in a constant state of that fight flight activation. And I was afraid that if I, you know, fell asleep, that I would do something in my sleep. I'd kill my kids and I'd wake up and discover them dead or something. And I wouldn't be able to take that back, you know? So it was really hard in those early, probably first 8 months, because I was just so paranoid about everything, so hypervigilant, so over aware of what was happening in my mind and my body that I just couldn't sleep. There was no resting. That's why I say, you know, I wasn't ever fully diagnosed at that point, right? This is all hindsight. And so part of me wonders if I was going through psychosis as well, because I was just so activated all the time. And while I didn't have hallucinations, I didn't have, you know, those delusional beliefs of like, I need to, you know, sacrifice my baby for him to be well or whatever. I did have a lot of the other symptoms of psychosis. And so I sometimes wonder if that may have been a component. I don't know.
Right. I mean, it sounds like it was so intense. Plus that paranoia that you're describing. I mean, sure, there's like levels of anxiety, paranoia being one of the most intense, but when it starts to tip over into those areas, it can become more sort of gray. It's hard to know. It can be hard to know. I mean, if you're with a really skilled clinician or somebody, you know, who can help you figure that out, it's easier. But I mean, so right, you're still kind of left with questions about it.
Yeah, I am. You know, even though my daughter's almost 8, I still have to like try to piece together, what was this? How, you know, how did I make it through this? And I think it was sheer, you know, willpower at that point to just power through and survive and make sure everyone was alive.
It's an incredible amount of time that you're talking about.
Yeah, it was.
Suffering at that high intensity. I mean, how long?
At least her first year. Initially, her first year was the hardest. I think I was about, from second trimester on. So it was a really, really long time. And I wasn't fully disclosing. I did go in and out to my midwife a lot. You know, I was asking her to run blood work and find a root cause because, like I said, I lost so much weight rapidly. I couldn't eat. I had so many different physical manifestation of symptoms in my body from the anxiety and from the OCD, you know, like intrusive thoughts about my health, about my kids' health, about harming them. There was, and I think the most terrifying and very under-acknowledged one for me, this is the one that really terrified my soul, was the sexual intrusive thoughts, the nature of that. I had never experienced that before, especially in relation to my children. And so that's what made me feel so much of a monster, because I thought, who the hell sees this stuff when they have kids?
Right.
And where is this coming from? No one had talked about it. And there was no literature for me to find on Google about it. And so I was so afraid to disclose any of that to anyone. But I try to have the courage now.
Of that, yeah, I'm really grateful that you talk about it. I agree, it's not discussed as much. It's a symptom that I experienced also, and it was horrifying. It was so terrible. But it's one of those things where people don't want to say anything because it can be easily misconstrued. Like you were saying before, if you say it to the wrong person at the wrong time or whatever, somebody might misinterpret what your experience is and start making assumptions about stuff. So it is hard to, I'm grateful that you're speaking out about it because it sucks. It's just horrible.
It is. It's really horrible. And when I did try to tell someone close to me that was in my immediate postpartum what I was seeing, the nature of those thoughts, I never saw them again. You know, they just completely cut contact. And then I felt again like, oh shit, I shouldn't have said anything. What does that mean? What does this person think of me now? And it was its own trauma and pain, you know, to have to go through that.
So can I ask you, I know you...
Before I found answers with my daughter.
It took you how long?
About 18 months postpartum.
How did you find those answers?
Honestly, that is hard to make sense of too. Because I was on Facebook and I made a very desperate like post about how I just couldn't take it anymore. And I was just at my wit's end. And I don't know how I was connected to this person on Facebook, but they saw my post and they commented on it and offered to speak to me. And so I messaged that person and at that point, I think I lost my grip on being able to keep it all inside. And I just was like, blah, here you go.
Right.
This is what's happening.
There's only so much you can hold in. We're not built to hold all of that in and for it to have no effect on us.
Yeah. And so that person then was able to normalize for me, like, oh, this is what's happening to you. It's not that you're a monster. It's not that this. And that's when I was like, oh, okay. Mm-hmm. This is the thing now. It's not just me and I'm not absolutely insane. Mm-hmm. And I'm not, you know, I don't need an exorcism and yada, yada, yada. You know what I mean? Like it was, it was relieving to finally have a space for someone to say, oh, I know what's happening to you and it's okay. And like, you're going to get through it. So that's how that began, was I initiated a relationship with this person. She was a, you know, mental health sort of outside of the system. You know, she's got all of the degrees and the training and the mental health, you know, background, but she doesn't have that license restricting her to only working in that one state. So she began a relationship with me and we started talking and it became therapeutic. And I spent about 5 years working with her and peeling, you know, the layers of all that was involved and all of my childhood and all of my, you know, experiences with relationships and all of the things that go into life, right? You know, just peeling all of that back, trying to make sense of what led to that, what, you know, how this got here, how to cope with that experience and that trauma and these thoughts. So yeah, it took a really long time, but it was like serendipitous, you know, she was there at the time that I was ready to lose it. And then that relationship was what helped me to move forward.
Well, hey there, busy mama. Are you looking for ways to make your life easier, your home less chaotic, and at the same time, add more joy to your life? My name is Deanna Yates, and I'm the host of Wanna Be Clutter Free, a podcast all about letting go of the stuff we don't need in our lives so that we can focus on what truly matters. Don't worry, I'm not going to tell you to throw it all away or make you feel guilty about keeping something you love, no matter how many other people don't quite understand it. But I will give you practical and, more importantly, actionable advice so that you can make progress right away. And you won't just hear it from me. There are amazing guests, too. It's like having your bestie in your pocket, telling you it's okay to let go of the things that are not serving you and your family in a totally non-judgmental way. So join me over on the podcast where we can work on progress over perfection for those of us that want to be clutter-free.
If you're a parent, I invite you to join us at the Mindful Mama podcast, where it's all about becoming a less irritable, more joyful parent. With sometimes hilarious and always thought-provoking experts and friends, at Mindful Mama, we know that you cannot give what you do not have. And when you have calm and peace within, then you can give it to your children. I'm Hunter Clark Fields, and I can't wait to see you there. Listen in to the Mindful Mama podcast.
I want to go back which is great. I'm so glad you found, or somehow that happened and you got your way to some healing. That's incredibly important. I know you said that for the second pregnancy, you didn't want to use any medications or have any medication intervention. Was there any point during that process where you thought about that maybe medication could help, or was it just like absolutely a no?
It was absolutely no. It was just not an option for me. I think I did take Ativan probably once or twice postpartum when I had her, and I think immediately something happened with like my liver enzymes. And so I was like, okay, I can't take any medications. Like my body's just out of whack. It's not handling things well. And I realized, you know, I just didn't want anything in the mix to give me more side effects than I was already experiencing. You know, I didn't know what was going on and what was connected to what and why I was experiencing all of these symptoms. And I didn't want to risk having more things added to complicate what I was already going through.
And it's so tough because you didn't at that time, anyways, while you were going through that part of a pregnancy and early postpartum, didn't have a connection to somebody who could help you figure that out. Like you not only were trying to survive all of what you were experiencing, but also trying to figure it out when you are not, I guess, like your functioning and your capacity for just getting through the day was so focused on just kind of, it sounds like survival.
Yeah.
That it's honestly, it's really hard to figure stuff out when you're in that state of mind because it's so intensely emotional and feels so overwhelming cognitively. That like putting energy into figuring something out, you might like have a couple of seconds where you can focus enough, but otherwise you're like you're drinking from a fire hose. It's
yes,
too much.
Yes, absolutely. That's kind of actually how it felt. It's a good representation of how much it felt like I was drowning and suffocating and so overwhelmed and just could not function. But I had to, you know, I had to show up every single day to make sure my son was okay and my daughter was okay. And, you know, I'm still alive at the end of this so that we can do this again tomorrow. And still, you know, I'm still waking up in this fresh hell every single day, just repeating it.
I do have a question about that, because sometimes there is a what somebody feels like internally is different from what they look like externally. So if somebody were to like walk, you know, see you outside, would they have noticed how much distress you were in? Or do you, and that's a little hard to say, but do you feel like it was so internal and you were just, you were doing all of the things so it looked like you were fine?
Yeah. I mean, I don't know, because so many people, well, you know, it's complex because I was not letting anyone in. First of all, I was keeping a pretty tight, like, boundary. And the people that did see me, you know, they would see me briefly and probably not realize how much internal, like, alarms were going off, because I was trying to make sure that no one suspected that I was a threat, that I was, you know, that my, I didn't want anyone to think I was crazy so that they would then, you know, try to take my kids. So I was trying to hold everything, you know, kind of like that fire hose, right? I was trying to like keep that from going off in public so that no one would suspect. I imagine, you know, my midwife probably had suspicions, but there was limited, you know, things that she could do in that regard. And maybe a neighbor might have, you know, because I would try to bring my kid over every once in a while, but couldn't last long in that environment due to my OCD and my contamination concerns and stuff. So they probably just thought I was like weird, you know, like, oh, she's really weird. I don't think they picked up the fact that I was just suffering immensely internally.
Right. And there's only a couple of people that know what's going on, and and not to the full extent.
I think I might have done a really well, you know, a good job at hiding it, which is tough, you know, because I desperately needed the help. And I wish somebody would have been able to reach out and like give me that hand and pull me out. But I wasn't allowing it to, you know, I wasn't going to show it to anybody.
Yeah, no, for sure. I mean, there's so many, from where I'm sitting, I guess there's so many layers of complexity for sure. But in particular for like pretending everything's okay and then also masking symptoms. If you, you know, as somebody who's neurodivergent and trying to get through the world, you already have a skill set.
At masking.
At masking and like pretending everything's okay. And then also as women, we do that. We've learned that along the way. And also as mothers.
Yep.
It's just like so many layers of pretending like everything's okay and compensating or overcompensating for the things where we feel like are our weaknesses or where people might judge us or all of that stuff. So like, even if you had none of the other stuff you were dealing with, just like the masking of everything is its own stress. It's so much work.
It
takes so much energy. So I like, by the time you reached that lady or she reached you or whatever happened there, you were ready to, I mean, you couldn't contain it.
Yeah. Because I had tried. I had tried to find a therapist. I had reached out to PSI and I had tried to find a therapist and I had shown up to that person's office and it was beginning the intake paperwork, I think. But she triggered me and I got the hell out of that office as fast as I could because I was like, she's not safe. I cannot disclose to her, even though I was told that she was, you know, the person to deal with perinatal mental health stuff. How she treated me and how my body received her was like, nope, gotta go, can't do it. So I shut it down and ran out. So there was like, I had a lot of barriers to care, even though I tried. You know, I went to a couple of doctors, like I told you, postpartum. I went to my midwife. I went to a different primary care physician and they actually dismissed me from their office. They sent me a letter in the mail and said, go find someone else.
What?
Yeah.
That is wild.
It was wild. I was like, why would a doctor abandon me during this situation? Because I was asking them for doing tests. Yeah, they just were like trying to offer me meds. I didn't want the meds. I said, I want you to find root cause, do the blood work, do the testing, figure it out. And then I got that letter in the mail and I was like, so devastated to be rejected by my own physician. And so,
I mean, I know that they unfortunately, not everybody is trained on how to notice some of the mental health signs or symptoms. And maybe they did. Who knows what their scope was or their capacity or whatnot. But still, like the net impact on you is like in some really horrible way, like rejection, but also potentially confirmation of like your own like worries about yourself.
Yeah, it was really hard to cope with. And it took a while. It was until I decided to go into massive debt and find a naturopath and charge that to my credit card to get answers, because I didn't have, you know, I didn't have it. I didn't have the money. I couldn't access these things, but I was bound and determined to get help. So I went into thousands of dollars of debt to work with a naturopath to get finally some confirmation of like, there is a physiological component here. And there is, you know, there are reasons for why this could be happening. And let's start working on that. And then therapy was another, you know, hurdle, but eventually I found someone to work with. So there were a lot of things that required me to pick myself back up after getting knocked on my butt.
Right. Right. Man, and you did. It always amazes me. I'm always sort of inspired, I guess, by how hard people try to get better, even when it feels impossible. There's like still that something in you that keeps going and pushing and trying to figure it out. And I mean, it's just, I don't know how all that shakes out, like how it actually happens. But, you know, if you're suffering, there's sometimes parts of you that want to just give up. And then there's this other part of you that wants to keep fighting. And so that part, at least from where I'm sitting, like that part won out and you found it.
It is. Yeah. You know, it's interesting that you mentioned that, because it does trigger a memory of like that wrestling between that suicidality and wanting to end it all and just stop suffering because you're in so much massive pain. And then that, like, I don't want anyone else to raise my children. I have to be here. I have to keep going. So I would be wrestling that every day, because it was just the thought of like leaving them behind and not getting to know them and having who knows what happened to them was like, nope, I can't do it. And that would be what kept me, you know, to get back up, to keep fighting.
Right. So your process, your healing process took a number of years.
It did. Yeah.
And I mean, you got the support you needed, you got the help you needed, and now you're supporting other people.
Yeah, I am. I went to, you know, take PSI's training. I got my PMHC. I volunteer with them now to help start mentoring other, you know, people who are going through this as well. And I try to educate care providers in my community, try to build that network. Where I was at when I gave birth to my daughter, like I told you, had no options. There was no one there trained in perinatal mental health. So I made it a goal of mine last year to reach out to other care providers and funnel them into training and get them on the path to certification so that there are options in that city now where, you know, there was nothing there for me when I was there.
Awesome.
Yeah.
That's amazing. I mean, you're having a big impact, I'm sure. That's to go from really nobody trained to having people around who know what to look for and maybe questions to ask. It's incredibly important.
Yeah, it was really, really important to me that nobody else have to suffer the way that I did, because I almost didn't make it through it. You know what I mean? Like, it was a miracle that I made it here at this point. So many other moms don't, you know, unfortunately, that is a real risk with this. And, you know, I don't want that to happen. As long as I'm here on this earth, I want to be able to make an impact so that other moms can get the safe help that they need and not have to worry about disclosing to the wrong person, losing their children, or potentially being separated from their children. Because, you know, that was a whole added layer. I didn't want to go to the ER. I didn't want to go and get help because I was breastfeeding my daughter and I didn't want to have to break that bond. Mm-hmm. I didn't want to have to choose, like, am I going to be there to feed my kid or can I go get the help that I need? So that really inspired me once I got my foot on the ground to be able to try and create these things that I needed that didn't exist.
That's beautiful. I'm so glad you made it through and that you have found enough healing to be able to help others.
Yeah, me too. I mean, it's been an immensely magnificent journey, full of pain and grief and loss and transformation and constant rebuilding of myself and trying to make sense of that and figuring out how to turn that into something I can give to the world. Because why else would I have gone through that? You know, like, I need to make it make sense. I need to make it have a purpose.
Yeah, for sure.
So otherwise, it's just torture for no reason, you know? So I'm like, I'm going to just do that best I can with what I went through for other people.
Yeah, that's awesome. Well, thank you, Tiffany, so much for coming on and sharing your story. There are so many parts of this that I know at least one person can resonate with, if not multiple parts of it. And also, you know, for people who are in the depths of struggling and can hear this and know that even when you feel as bad as you felt, that there is a way to get better and feel better is so important. And you've given people a lot of hope today. So thank you for that.
Yeah, thank you so much, Dr. Kat, for giving me the space to share my story and holding it so tenderly. I really appreciate that. And I really do want to leave your audience with that hope, you know, even if it feels utterly hopeless, take that step for yourself because you deserve it. And I will hope that, you know, you find what you need to get better.
Absolutely. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you again, Tiffany. And if you guys would like to get connected with her, you can go to TiffanyEngenDoula.com or on Instagram, Tiffany E. Full Spectrum Doula. For anyone out there who feels like they might be experiencing something like this, you can always reach out to postpartum.net, Postpartum Support International, and look at the wide variety of support options that are free for you. There are online support groups. There's a provider directory. There is a peer support program. And PSI can help get you connected to the help you deserve and need. Please be sure you're subscribed to the Mom and Mind podcast so that you receive all of these episodes downloaded to you directly to your phone. It is free. And the only thing you need to do is subscribe so that you can access all of the episodes and pick and choose the ones that you want to listen to. There are over 330 episodes and counting to pick from. And one or many of them could meet your needs. You can go to any podcast platform, or you can go to wellmindperinatal.com to see all of those episodes laid out. There's a search function on the website, so you can look into what topics you'd prefer to listen to. And you can also check out the courses page and see what I'm offering there for people who need a little bit extra support, especially when you're waiting for a therapist. There are some courses on there to help you understand and cope with what you're going through. Thank you so much for being with us. Until next time.
Please find the Mom and Mind podcast on momandmind.com or wellmindperinatal.com, where you can also find access to my free online mini course that is specifically designed for people experiencing anxiety in the postpartum period. Or you can learn more about the 3.5-hour self-paced course that I created just for managing postpartum stress. You can also connect with us on social media at Mom and Mind on Instagram and Facebook. Thank you for tuning in and learning more about perinatal mental health.
Oh, hey, everybody.
It's us, Blair and Molly, your old pals from Toddler Purgatory. Two moms who are also actors, who are also creative beings, who sometimes feel stuck.
And this is our new podcast, Unsticking It with Blair and Molly. What happens when your creative spark just seems to disappear? Gone.
Poof. Bye.
See ya. What happens when life gets in the way of your creativity instead of nourishing it? That's what happened to Molly and me. We felt like the thing that drove us creatively stopped working and impending doom had in fact impended.
Totally. So we decided to do something about it. And that was steal ideas about getting unstuck from the most creative people we can find. We talked to guests about how to break through the mucky, gluey, sticky wall that can get between you and your creativity. We hear about their journeys, their successes, their challenges, and even their bougie coffee shop orders.
And we're not just talking Bob Ross type paint on paper artists here, though we talk to them too. We're talking to actors, creative directors, dancers, and people who are working hard to be their best creative selves in a world that can sometimes feel real uncreative.
We all have something to teach each other, so let's steal their ideas together.
Join us, won't you, as we deep dive into how to unstick ourselves from the life gunk that can get in the way of our creative freedom. Pandemics, school calendars,
world events, lack of sleep. Oh, get out of their life gunk.
And let's get back to your best creative self. Subscribe to Unsticking It with Blair and Molly.
You're not going to want to miss an episode.
Unsticking It with Blair and Molly, because sometimes life sucks.
Unsticking It.